So we'll continue from yesterday. And what did we learn yesterday? Basically, it's this thing. And plus some weak theorems. We're going to review them. But today, we're going to do the gory detail of the hunt for fermionic Feynman rules. So when I was a graduate student, you know, I think I was given a bunch of Feynman rules. Then I have lots of homework to calculate using them. How did I feel? I don't remember. I didn't feel anything. I have to do my homework. Like I was too busy to feel. then, so somehow things calmed down a bit in the later part of my journey. I found it deep and satisfying. Where do all these rules come from? There are so many more rules. And it has, like, compared to bosonic Feynman rules, instead of this external leg is just one, we will soon see. After this lecture, the fermionic has like an external leg rule for like there were four of them, for example. And there were some minor signs. They are very tricky. So the goal of today's lecture is trying to find these Feynman rules. So I have a recipe. This is mine. It says that if I want to do this hunt, by the way, apparently gory means, of course I learned from Dan, gory means like disgusting, like a similar level. It's just like that kind of thing. I find that it might be also a great preparation for the upcoming Halloween. Okay, the recipe is that, let's say, first I pick a theory. I have to know what I'm calculating. And the second, I'll pick a process. In one theory, as you probably experience in your homework three, you can have lots of different process. Pick what we want to calculate. And then we can draw Feynman diagrams. Drawing Feynman diagrams doesn't require Feynman rules. And then we're going to use LSC to compute scattering amplitude. And we're going to compare and gain insights. And we're going to repeat in case we haven't found all the rules. I mean, this recipe is not hard to understand. Basically, the idea is this Feynman diagram, some wiggly lines. Most of us we are going to see today something like this. Doesn't matter the arrows now. It's like the ones you see in your homework. Plus, Feynman rules. So this is what Feynman says. These two things together is equals to scattering amplitude. And since we want to use Feynman rules, we just need to find the scattering amplitude and subtract the Feynman diagram, right? So this is where the part of five comes in. So we're going to follow this route. Before that, let me refresh again, how do we actually do this part? Clearly, of the entire process, this part is the hardest. I think this is just cherry picking. So you can just write down a random theory and conjecture a random process, such as two fermion to two fermion. Drawing a Feynman diagram at this point is hopefully is not hard for you anymore. If you have drawn this guy in your homework, then drawing the Feynman diagram for fermions is not hard. But this is going to take us a while, a long while. But then we can extract the Feynman rules. Of course, this part will also take some careful thought. How could we compare this part. Yeah, it takes some. It doesn't take much time, but we have to gain the insights. But of course, the harder part is this. So I want to review this part yet again. So it's basically what we did yesterday. And summarized by this super long formula that they indeed didn't erase, which is very nice of them. Thank you. So when we stare at this formula, I want to emphasize a couple things, maybe even more than a couple. So let me write here the comments, because I need the whole board later to do a calculation. So for the first comment is, remember all those integrals, which is defined to be b1 plus minus plus infinity minus infinity, which is one of your quiz, one of the harder derivation I ask you to do in the quiz. This thing is defined to be integrals. Remember how last Friday, you have lots of little practice ask, what is this thing? And this thing, today, the most important character I want to emphasize about the annihilation operator B is that it does not have a spinner index. Which means it's Lorentz invariant. Which means this whole thing, all this thing is Lorentz invariant, which make a lot of sense for calculating a scattering amplitude. It shouldn't depend on which frame are you in. And for very, very specific, now I will invite you to particularly look at one of these guys. Let's see, what kind of color chalk that's available and distinguishable from white? So I want to invite you to look at this guy. That's the guy we calculate. That's one of the guys we calculate. This is actually precisely, of course, we have to pick J equals 4. This is precisely what we calculate, which is called I4. Which is defined the same way you use B4. And remember, B4 is a very convenient way denoting the force momentum and the force spin label. Okay, look at this guy. This guy is Lorentz invariant, and it is because we are able to restore its spinner index. Here is a spinner index, and it's a Dirac operator, so it also has spinner index, and the spinner, of course, has a spinner index. So those spinner indices will play a crucial role when we are trying to extract one of the Feynman rules. Basically, at some point, we need to keep track all of this spinner index to figure out eventually which U's get to contract with UH U bar. That's what those spinner index will tell us. So this is my first comment. Every single integral you stuck into the LSC, they are individually Lorentz invariant, and all the three parts carry spinner index, which we'll have to keep track of later. My second comment is that, let's look. So yesterday, in the quiz, we asked the question about this particular Dirac operator. I think all of you guys got it. And let me emphasize again, what this notation mean? Let me write the thing that everybody does understand, which is this guy. Perfectly understandable. And let me restore the spinner index again. The only thing about this pretty left arrow is this is a definition and it's a notation only. Now, don't put too much meaning to it. It's just a notation. And of course, in the next line, it's another notation only thing that I do not want to you to associate too much meaning to it. It's a notation. You just pull this thing to the right and add the arrow. This is completely definition. And the next line is the definition of this slash notation. And you can always restore your spinner index. And let me emphasize all this derivative operator slash the derivative operator now come with a subscript. That denotes that which derivative it will act on. If you just look at this thing, look, we integrated over four different force space-time. So it's d4x1, d4x2, d4x3, d4x4. And then our partial derivative does come with a subscript set to instruct us which derivative, which space-time dependence it's act on. So that's why it has a subscript. And this will become important later. And the third point, which is the last question on the quiz. And there is a sign error, so I can't remember this particular sign. Okay, so what you have seen in the quiz, first part, most of you, almost everybody saw this, is that the Feynman fermionic propagator is a Green's function for Feynman, for Dirac operator. This is just a notation for that. We're gonna write a tons of those things today. So we'll just say, forget about the Feynman, and then we'll just write down who minus whom as a subscript. So this is a notation you don't have to use. You don't have to use any notation that is commonly used. And this notation is not even commonly used. But today I'll use this notation so that this board, look at this huge board, will be big enough for our calculation. The later half. Okay, so we all have seen that. But at this point, I just want to emphasize. The Dirac operator is a matrix in the spinner index. Yeah? So they're secretly. Okay, let me do this thing again. And I have a slash lost. That's where the index are. Okay, let me do it again. Yet again, we'll restore some spinner index. So secretly, there is some spinner index on the right too. Remember your Feynman propagator? Feynman propagator is I'll forget about the I also might lost the minus sign. Not lost the sign. This is especially bad because I'm not using this today. Ah, right. I was right. I lost a minus. Sorry. Here we go. So this thing also has spinner index. this thing secretly has spinner index because the slash, and so this one has to have spinner index for them to be able to add. So this whole thing, then what you have in your when you calculated this is as a Green's function, it actually also carry the spinner index, which I'll just also write it here. So this is my first comment about yesterday's quiz. This will also become important for the same reason we're going to trace all the spinner index and figure out which U and U bar will be connected together. And that will lead us to one of the important families. Yeah.
Could you read out the spinner index indices? I can't read them in
the Okay. Way. So there is AB here. AB is on the slash. AB is on the identical matrix. And there is BC on P, that is a slash. There is BC on the identity. And then so after you multiply out, this one should have an AC index. So this is a point that might be missed. And then the final comment, let me make sure I get the sign right, is that for the last question of the quiz, that I'm not going to derive this on board. And it is derived in the note, in the footnote, as I mentioned, is that this is also a Green function of the Dirac operator for the Dirac conjugate spinner. So this can be proven to be true. On the other hand, we should have expected to be true. Because, look, there is the Dirac operator over here, and we have shown this Dirac operator will kill some of the propagators in the middle because this thing you showed. This is what you commonly heard people talk about. The propagator is the inverse of the operator. Well, what about these guys? These guys are also Dirac operator, and it naturally shows up when we derive the LSC reduction formula. It needs to kill some propagator in the middle, otherwise our result would have a Dirac operator hanging up. Because we never have Klein-Gordon operator hanging out in Feynman rule in the scattering amplitude. That's not what we expect. We expected all this Dirac operator somehow disappear when we get down to the end. So that's why I say I'm expecting this thing will also find a Feynman propagator, which is the Green's function of this operator, and gave me delta. Deltas are nice. Delta is very nice for doing integrals. Yeah? So that's the comments I want to make about this gigantic formula that we're going to use. So then what we did is called a technique. The technique we say is that we find a fermion, and we find a fermion bar, then we can contract them, and we get this, using new notation, propagator 1, 2. It's a fermion Feynman propagator. Yeah? So the only thing I want to mention, which is not the hardest thing you could envision, is if I have a bunch of them, and if I want to get one out, I want to bring them together, but I swap things, so I get a minus sign. But now they're together, I can bring it out. Yeah? So the idea is, since whenever you swap fermions, you pick up a minus sign. So in order, one way of just, it's like a bookkeeping scale. is that we always contract, start with the field followed by the bar field. If you always do that, we will always get propagator out instead of the minus propagator out. It's just a bookkeeping skill. You don't have to do it. You can try to contract it that way, but then there's more minus sign to take care of. So bookkeeping, always follow this. And for today, we couldn't care less what exactly is the Feynman propagator. We only need to know that eventually it will be killed by some operators. So that's all I want to say about a weak theorem, is that you get a Feynman propagator, and when you have multiple of them, you want to bring something together, look like this, and pick up various number of minus signs, and then you can bring the propagator out. And of course, only the fully contracted ones have any meaning. Otherwise, it's zero. Sorry, I also want to say something else about a weak theorem. We were saying yesterday, but it's worth mentioning again. If you just look at the creation and annihilation operator in those fields, then they are all different. They have the wrong operators. They are not going to give me anything except zero. And here is a new thing. Is it different species always give zero? For example, if I have a scalar and then you say, what is a contract to the fermions? No, it's zero. You can't contract the scalar into fermions. It doesn't even talk to each other. All right.
And the reverse answer, why that's right? Like, why is that always generally true?
Because if phi gave you a type of operator produces some scalar. Remember when we derived this yesterday, if you look at the notes how we derived this, at some point we need to calculate a nth commutator. And if you have a from a operator from a scalar quantization and an operator from a fermion quantization, they've never met. You can't do that calculation. Well, this one you really can't do. You can't ask a question. So what's a propagator? Propagator asks, I have a start with a fermion with, say, spinning up, electrons spinning up, and then I ask, with some interaction Lagrange, it propagate, and what's the probability of finding it in some other state? And when the fermion propagate, it never touch an interaction vertex. It will never turn into a scalar. That's the propagator always stay with the same type of particle. A real scalar field, it propagates. It will never turn into a complex scalar field until you hit a vertex. So now we're just talking about a propagator. We're just talking about in your Feynman rule, it's just a line. And then beginning of the line of and the end of the line, maybe your spinner index turn from A to B. That's possible. But you from a spinner somehow propagate, turn into a scalar, that's just not possible. You have to stick with that. Then, like, that's how we define a spinner and a scalar, that they are different Lorentz representation for Lorentz transformation. They don't change by purely propagating. They're just like literally just traveling along. Okay, I think that's all I want to emphasize before we start the calculation. And now let's start the calculation. Pick a theory. So before we pick a theory, we'll do something called the dimension analysis. I'm not sure you have seen this before, but in field theory, particle physics, we always choose C equals H bar equals 1. And the good thing about this is everything have exactly, there are only one independent dimension possible, which is the mass. So this guy is one mass. Since momentum is mass times some velocity, and the velocity is taken to be a pure number. So momentum is the same as mass. It's also one. These things are called a mass dimension. And by definition, mass has mass dimension one. And for momentum, it has one. And if you think about x, which is the position, because position times momentum give you h bar, so that's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So this one has minus one. And the last one is time, because time and the position is related by velocity again, so they have the same mass dimension. And from now, then we can look at the mass dimension of different kind of field. For example, I'm sure you are very familiar with this Lagrangian too. So the question is, what's a dimension of the Lagrangian? With what we start is the action. Let me just write it. Action has dimension zero. Because remember, you do any sort of partition function, you often write as e to the minus s over h bar. And h bar is a number. The numbers do not have dimensions. So action is zero, and we're going to integrate it over d4x. So action is integrated over d4x of Klein-Gordon. So this part contributes negative 4. So we conclude the Lagrangian must give you positive 4 mass dimension. To be, your goal is for action to have no dimension. Otherwise, exponential, anything that has any dimension doesn't make any sense. So actually, it's easy to generalize. It has nothing to do with if it's Klein-Gordon Lagrangian anyway. Any Lagrangian in 4 dimension always have mass dimension 4. And of course, you wonder in n dimension that they will have dimension n. Then, normally you look at the mass term. So the mass term contributes, of course, to mass dimension. So 2 plus 2, whatever the dimension phi is, should be 4. So you conclude this mass dimension of the scalar field has dimension 1, mass dimension 1, of energy dimension 1. Yeah? Have you seen this?
I don't see the last one.
I'm looking at this term. So this mass contributes dimension, mass dimension 1, but it's mass square. So that's why, okay. So this is how each thing contribute. And we need to multiply by the power of the thing. So the mass contributed 1, and the power is 2. So this part contributes 2. The mass dimension is something I don't know, but it has 2 powers. So, and I know it always add up to 4. So this gave me this. And we're going to do it for Dirac. It's always easier to look at the mass term. Here's what I got. Okay, so I'm just going to not go that again, because I know it's going to be plus 4. So this time, I have one mass. See, one mass. That's what I know. But then I don't know what's beside this dimension. Then they add up to be 4. So then I solve this as Dirac field has dimension 3/2. And you're like, why these are useful? These are, I'll state something you will learn in more detail in QFD2. The statement is that all operators have mass dimension 4 are known as irrelevant operator. This just means that they are less important in infrared. So you will study where that statement comes from in detail, in a lot of detail, in the next course. But that's what people, there's also the other claim is that they are non-renormalizable. More jargons. But the idea is, as a first glance at the quantum field theory, we do not care about any operator has more than dimension 4. We'll care about them later. Those involve effective theory and stuff, but let's just forget about them because they are not important somehow. And you will study this statement, why that is true. So basically, let me say one more sentence. Basically, all this interaction term comes with a coupling constant. And the coupling constant, as you learn QFT2, will change as a function of the energy. And IR means low energy. What you will see in QFT2 is your coupling constant will become smaller in low energy if you have too big a mass dimension. But if you think about it, 4 is not that big. 4 is basically like 4 scalars. That's why you study lambda 5/4. You never bother to study lambda 5/5 or 6. And you study 5/3. And then what we also look at is that now let's think about fermion interaction. They each already count for 3/2. And we also spend a long time to argue that if you want to interact with fermions, it's always, always bilinear. So now there's a 3 mass dimension right here. And you want an interaction. There's one left. Oh, that one. Maybe this is not how Yukawa write down his interaction term. But basically, if you want a fermion, a scalar interact and has some importance in the infrared, that's the only term you can write down. Okay, I'm lying a little bit. Actually, there's some possibly gamma 5 there, but let's ignore gamma 5 at this point. Okay, so here we go. We have our interaction. So this is gonna be the interaction theory we're gonna study. And the reason and the motivation is this is the only theory, the only renormalizable theory. Okay, so that's the theory. Let's pick a process. There's no point for me to pick a process other than this process I have already calculated so hard, right? So we're gonna pick 2 by 2, 2 fermion, 2 fermion. And our starting point is that. Two fermion. Done. Next, draw Feynman diagrams. Well, to gain some insight from the next step of the after LSC reduction form. Before I draw, see, the thing about drawing Feynman diagrams is one of the things to know is how many vertices. Yes?
So, mass dimension of the Gamma matrices is zero.
Zero.
So, like,
number.
You put in n number of Gamma matrices there.
That's true.
What is the difference in the theories? Like,
the parity.
Difference or
parity.
Parity.
If you put a Gamma 5, it's parity. But if you put anything not a gamma 5, you will have a Lorentz index. You can't use a scalar, you have to use a vector. Or something carry Lorentz index. And which, since we have a context vector, that'll be the topic of Thursday. So we can't do that. The only thing we have is scalar and affirmance. So I'm telling you the truth. This is the unique theory we can study up to a gamma 5, which let's not worry about a gamma. Okay, Feynman diagrams, the key of drawing Feynman diagrams, in my opinion, that is to know how many vertices are there. Yeah? Even if you just asked me, my first thing is, can I draw anything without a vertex? Oh, I can, but that doesn't count as interaction. So let's start with one vertex and see if I can draw anything, and then move on from there. Like 1, 2, 3, 4, so on and so forth. Okay, but today, since I'm going to try to do calculation, I'm trying to gonna draw some Feynman diagrams with the guidance of the Dyson formula, which is basically we are start calculating this thing. So remember this guy. Yesterday I didn't really say anything about this guy. It's because there's nothing fundamental change. And then there is will be the e to the I interaction. And then there will be that. And then you want to divide it the e to the I interaction Lagrangian thing away. So we know what's this thing. These are some vacuum bubbles get divided away. And we just say it's not very today because we're doing trade. We're going to do leading order calculation today. We'll find the first non-trivial calculation. Okay, so basically we're stuck with this guy. And here is where perturbation theory starts. And then you say order zero. Well, order zero, of course you can. It order zero give you something, if you remember, it's like this. Two fermions come, two fermions go. There's no interaction. So there's really no point calculating them. Because that always happens. Okay. So this is called the elastic scattering. We never care about them when we do scattering amplitudes, because there is really no scattering. And what about order one? Our interaction Lagrangian is over there. Order one, I'll pick up this term. Let me give them some subscript, just where am I going to integrate it over that. So this is the thing. In addition to that thing, I have this. What do you think about this term? What do you think about the order one contribution?
It's zero.
It's zero because
you're gonna contract all of them.
Exactly. We can't contract all of them. There is like seven of them. Zero because do not have full contraction. Oh, you can, another way to say it is there's a scalar there and it cannot find any other scalar to contract. So this scalar become very frustrated and turn into a zero in the vacuum expectation. So it's clear to us now that if we want to get anything out of this, we have to do a second order calculation. As you can see how long this calculation is, I'm moving to a new board. Which is also our leading order. So this is the expansion, and this is whatever I have before. And now I have a integral. Let's throw the integral away for now. I have a phi y, cosine y bar, cosine y. Now I have phi z, cosine z bar, cosine z. That's the calculation we need to do. And that's the first half of the hard calculation we need to do today. Right? I didn't do anything very stunning. What I did is expanded an exponential, which I'm sure after homework 3, you are very good at this. Maybe it's not this particular interaction, but you are very good at writing this stuff. Spotlight. There is a pair of scalar. Yay! And then we have 8 fermion fields waiting to be contracted to each other. Let me point out something. For example, we don't really want to contract the guys with 1, 2, 3, 4, 3. These guys are the external ones. Right? To themselves. If you ever contract an external leg to an external leg, you'll go back to that situation. You're going to have some disconnected diagram and then argue them they are not important. So that makes things a little easier. There is 4 externals and 4 internals. Let me pick it out for you. But here is when, before we carry out this calculation, is when we now start to think about it. Okay, great. We figured out a second order means 2 vertex. I can draw 2 vertex. And they say it's a 3-field interaction. There are 3 field participating. So I draw 3 little lines out of my 2 vertexes. I don't know, that's just how I draw my diagram. And then somehow this tells me that this calculation says, oh, the scalar thing must be connected together. I'm just going that you dashed for scalars and not dashed for fermion. Well, this seems to be a pretty good Feynman diagram. Well, at this level, that it has 4 external legs and have 2 vertexes, and they are contracted because of the scalar. And then if I think really hard about this, then I'll probably discover another one says, well, nobody says this guy has to come out here. I can switch them. See, these are actually different Feynman diagrams, because if I label this 1, 2, 3, 4, then there's difference. This one says this fermion 1 become a fermion 3. This one says fermion 1 actually become a fermion 4. So I have two Feynman diagrams. Maybe there's some y and a z I could label the internal vertexes. And at this point, before doing further calculation, I'm not sure what I should do. That's the only thing I should do is I calculate. If I use my Feynman rules, apply this to diagram, I should get the same scattering amplitude as evaluate this plugin LST. That's all I would do. Okay. So now it's your turn. Because there's no way I can somehow contract 8 fermion fields into 4 pairs and then convince you my contraction is right. And somehow that actually stick in your head so you can contract. So I'm going to slowly write out my solution of how to contract the remaining 8 fermion fields and turn them into Feynman propagator and then take them out. And you are going to do it in a group, as much discussion as you want, whichever two fields you want to contract first, have lots of discussion, but I want to know what this turn is. And you can, you know, take your break, get a fresh cup of coffee if you need it for this calculation. But I need you to calculate this thing. Basically, I need it to turn into 4 Feynman propagators. And according to my Feynman diagram, there should be 2 ways of doing it. There are 2 completely distinctive Feynman diagrams, so there must be 2 ways of doing this, contracting those 4 Feynman propagators. So as a starting point, I would say I found the psi 4, which is external, and the first internal I can extract with is this guy. This guy has a bar, this guy is an internal field, so that would be the first thing I do. And what? How do you do the rest? Plus sign or minus sign that comes out when I do it? It's completely up to you. And now will be your break. And we'll compare results in 20 minutes. 25 if needed. I really want you to do this calculation. So, and it's very possible that you are asked to do one of these calculations in your interview.
Yeah, so you can see
that watching me doing that calculation is not a very instructive. You actually want to take your fermion with you and move it around yourself. And mine is probably not optimal of how to contract, which one to contract them first. But I did it, I picked one from the external, one from the internal. So these are my choices. I know this is gonna give me a propagator and I need to bring them together. I'll bring this one over here. And then I say I have to do 3 swaps. I pick up 3 minus signs. And we do the same, keep turning pair of fermion fields into minus signs and propagators. And there is a minus one in front of my propagator. And then I decide that how do I bring these guys together? I stay the same. But for the last little step, instead of 1 goes to Z, 1 goes to Y, this time 1 goes to Z, and I get 2 different things. And if you look at this, this corresponding to the right process. And then this guy corresponding to the left process. And then, of course, the thing I'm going to emphasize is there is a crucial minus sign. About this minus sign, that a lot of people have asking questions that, for example, isn't this just Fermi-Dirac statistics? Yes, that's exactly true. I saw 2 fermions coming out. They are indistinguishable. I have no idea. So consider this blue box a black box. 2 fermions are sending in, 2 fermions coming out. The scientist there, suppose there's some guy, the hockey stick scientist, will see a fermion coming at him. He has no idea that this fermion is coming from this process or that process. And that's why there is a relative minus sign between these two processes, because basically you took two fermions that is indistinguishable and you swap them. And about Feynman diagram, let me emphasize again, we want to fix our external legs. To consider me as this initial left scientist, and Navita is the other one, as two. So this is 1, 2. And remember, hockey stick is 3. And the screen is number 4. So these are very good questions has been asked during the break. Says that, so why would this contributing differently? So if you look into the black box, this number 3 hockey stick scientist would receive a fermion, but it could either interact with my fermion, with the fermion 1, or it never have interact with my fermion. So that's why there are two distinguishable processes. So if you carry this calculation, you would think in my final result, if I just swap Y and Z here, it is seemingly I'm going to get a different answer. But that doesn't count as distinctive, because remember, in our this guy, there is an integration over d for y and d for z. They are integrated over, so that the label doesn't count. So that just means the internal vertex has been swept. So if I take this guy, write down the propagator, exactly the same except swapping one z, by the first look, it's exactly the same. It's not the same result. But if you think about it, eventually we're going to integrate it over y and z, so they are the same. But don't worry about this. You have seen this before. This factor of 2 precisely cancel out that factor of 2. Same thing happened the other way. So this is our potential scattering amplitude, as long as we're willing to stick in that thing.
Luca?
Yeah.
Do we need to include the factor of minus psi when we swap between psi and psi? Not psi and psi bar.
Yes, we do, because psi and psi also anti. That's the sign coming from time ordering. Remember, there's a huge time ordering in front, and that time ordering says he doesn't really care about what you are swapping, as long as it's a fermion field, we need to pick up a minus sign. So there is that, remember that argument? Because this thing still anti-commute. Okay, let me give them some label. And now if you time ordering them, if you don't include another minus sign, then there's contradiction. So we always pick up minus sign if you're swapping fermions with fermions. Scalars, they don't have any minus. Yep.
So if we swap 1 and 2,
yeah,
same one, but like.
Yeah. So you could say I can also swap 1 and 2. So that's. Try to swap them. And da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
You could do that, but basically, if you swap the result here with 1 and 2, basically you get that one, which means, yes, from the first process, you could try to get a different process by swapping like 1 and 2, but then realize that the result is the same as this guy. So there's a bunch of eternal like swapping symmetries. Yeah.
So, like considering like the we can't write like S4Y as SY4, like that order matters,
right.
In our bottom where,
yeah.
Or we could like do it
every exactly that's a very good point about the fermions. That's exactly what I'm saying, is that you can it's a bookkeeping skill that I always write this as S for Y. But if you write S Y 4, I would have thought you mean this way. But if you say, can I just swap the X and the Y in the fermion propagator, we can't, because all these minus signs could pop up. That we definitely suggest you not to do it. Yep.
I don't understand why these processes contribute differently. Like you made an argument saying.
Why would I say, why this deep? Yes, that's the argument that I was trying to make, is that I'm this scientist number one, and there is a scientist number three on the hockey stick. And if you ask the scientist number three, you got a fermion, but does your fermion has interacted with Y, what number one, my fermion? Or your fermion hasn't interacted with my fermion, your fermion interacted with fermion number two. These are two completely different processes. Like, what a fermion has interacted with the alpha fermion or not, it's different. Although it's not detectable, but that's distinctive. That's the difference between these two processes. Is that if you separatedly in the four scientists doing the experiment a lot by space, you can ask this kind of question. You say, oh, you got a fermion, great. Is it coming from the process that your fermion interacted with my fermion? Or is it coming from the process that your fermion would interact with her fermion? And that's a question that a scientist is not able to answer because everything is in a black box. But if you look into the black box, this is exactly what we're doing. We look into the black box and decided, yes, these two are very different, two very different process. And of course, in order to see they are indeed a different process, I need to put it in LCSC, come up with a scattering amplitude. And as you can see at the end, the scattering amplitude of these two processes are indeed different. Yep.
Do the propagators themselves
come here? The propagators themselves, they are, well, okay. If you just label them always a spinner index, then they commute. Like they have to carry their spinner index, then they become a certain element in the matrix. Then they commute. At this point, yes, they are a bunch of a matrix, and we are going to keep the order, not swap them. But we're going to restore their spinner index so that we can keep track in the end of what happens in the scattering amplitude. So there is one crucial rule about fermions, and it's only clear if we keep track of this spinner index. But your question has to wait a bit. We have to see the scattering amplitude.
Sorry,
yep.
When you say carrying the same spinner index, you mean like if we consider like a component?
Right. So whenever if you say so at this point I forgot which index they should carry, but at any point in our life, if we have these spinner matrices, and as long as you write out all their index, you are always free to trade them around. But that's only when you carry the spinner index, because at this point, as we emphasize, several times already, that the spinner, the fermion propagator is a matrix.
It's just we could have pulled them out differently, like in a different order, then you would end up with a different ordering of the propagators.
Ah, okay. Maybe. Okay, let's wait until when I restore all the spinner indexes and see if that thing gets clear. The thing is I'm trying to argue is the carry spinner index gets contracted with different guys. And so they don't carry the same spinner index. Like the problem about like commuting of them is that if they have the same spinner index, so if you have AB, B, B, C, then you get a matrix C, A, C, then the claim is don't do that. this is not a community. But if I have this guy carry spinner index AB, but this guy carries CD, they don't turn into a matrix. Of course, you can just swap them. That's what I suspect is going on. But this is a very good question. As I said, my answer is I suspect. So very good question, and we'll see if this is what actually goes on. When I do this calculation, as you can see, that I clean up the board as much as I could, and hopefully this board is good enough. Okay, there's also other very good questions asked during the break. It says, but what if I swap these things? How did I come up with this order of 4, 3, 1, 2? That's a very good question. Of course, you swap them, you get a minus sign. But this minus sign can be argued to be, it's okay. So the idea is for any order of fermions, once you pick order, let's calculate the LSC reduction formula, then you get something like that. And then as we show is that you get some scattering amplitude and you get some other scattering amplitude, and it turns out there's a minus sign. And then the next thing to do is to take a square of it, quote unquote square. And the idea is, of course, I can swap them. Swap to external leg. What that does, of course, if you're swapping things, you basically flip everybody's sign. But that's okay. Because if you have an overall sign in front of all scattering amplitude, that can be squared away. It's only eventually your answer will agree with each other. And then maybe your answer will only agree each other when you realize, oh, your particle 3 is my particle 4. Like, we're just naming it different. So that sign is okay. But once you pick, you realize there is still a relative sign between these two processes. And if you look at that, why do I say this is the left process? This one says the propagator goes from particle 1 to y to 4. Wait, no, this is the right process, sorry. If I look at my propagator, it says 1 to y to 4. And that's exactly what happened, 1 to y to 4. So this one is the right process, and in this case, I have 1 go to z equal to 3. So that's apparently this process with my vertex labeled different. Any question before I do this calculation? Yeah? So first of all, it's very important for you to be able to show that a fermion correlation operator can produce two different results, and they are different by a minus sign. And then, so you want to be fluent with this process, and it's very good that you're going to practice this afternoon again. And compared to this minus sign, so this minus sign is summarized by this brilliant rule called Fermi-Dirac. It says you have two fermions coming out of progress. Those fermions don't carry labels 3 and 4. They are indistinguishable. You swap them, you have a minus sign. The minus sign you're going to discover in this afternoon will be much more complicated. Discovering the minus sign is equally complicated, but how to phrase it in a way called a Feynman rule is somewhat complicated. All right, so here we are. We have calculated what this crazy thing in this sandwich. And as you can see, I try to avoid the rewrite LSC fermionic reduction formula in my life as little times as possible. I'm going to erase what this thing is and put, let's see, what did I try to put? Okay, I tried to calculate this. In this case, trying not to do things different from what I've done yesterday or before, some time ago. Okay, so this is what's in the middle. And this minus sign, I'm just going to throw all the way here. This is the process with minus, also known as the write process. And what else I lost? I lost a integral of dy integral of dz. And I also lost this minus lambda over this thing. So there is a overall factor of that. And I stuck all my propagator into the middle of the LSC reduction formula. And I'll remember at some point to integrate over my internal vertex. Okay? Yeah?
I just have two. So when we were contracting these, we could get four different results, but two of them are the same when we integrate over one.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And the other thing, we're missing our bosonic propagator in there.
Right. Here. I'm just saying I'm going to copy this guy down again. Just only focus on this.
Okay.
So because this guy is literally just a function.
Yes, we can.
So it can just tag along all the way.
Yeah, I just mean we can just take it out as well.
Not really, because remember,
sorry.
Remember now we have to integrate over. So I can't just take it out anymore.
Too many things.
Okay, so let's do it. Where is my beautiful Green's function? That's our hope, that this thing will turn into something that I can look at. All right, so let's take the four guy. So when j equals four, this guy is going to acting on this guy and give me delta x4 minus y. Yeah? So that's one of my Green function. It turns out it's okay. So there are some i's, there are some minus i's. They can be thrown away because for the two different process, they will come out to be an overall sine factor. So I'm just not keeping track of them. I'm just looking, focusing on the delta functions. So there's more thing to focus on. Remember that there used to be a Poisson 4 carry the spinner index B, because 4 disappeared, turned into a propagator. So this guy must carry some spinner index like that. So this 4 is coming from, remember the first thing I emphasize is that this thing together with the Poisson is Lorentz invariant. That's what we have for integral. Since that Poisson has to have a spinner index B to cancel out all the spinner index. Since that guy has been absorbed into this propagator, so this propagator had a better carry, the same in index and the C.
So I think we had the room scheduled from 10:30 onward. If you just let me know how long you need, we can try to find another solution.
Sorry, I think I needed at least until 11.
Okay.
Maybe even the 11:15. I really don't want to cut short anywhere, sorry.
Sure. Okay, all right, just wanted to double check.
Thank you so very much. I just didn't check the booking today. And yeah, sorry for the, okay. I can't cut this lecture in anywhere without turning it into two lectures. So let's just stay with me with this calculation. And so for the same reasoning, this guy must also have a new set of index. Let's call it C, C, D, and D, E. So there are two sets of this. and then there's only, oh, I can write it on the upper here. Yeah, is it clear? There's A, A, B, B from the psi 4, and there is the C, C, D, E from the psi 3. So that's how we restore the spinner index of this, is to keep track of where they come from in our beautiful integral.
Because the two C's are different.
Ha! Good question. Why would I pick it to be C?
Start on B for the other one.
Okay, C, T. No, I can just pick some weird index.
F.
Okay, A, A, B, B, F, C, C, D, D, E. Okay, so that's good. But remember, on this side, I can do the same thing. So these two guys also carry some index. And it's probably reasonable to assume that this SY1 share a Y with this guy probably carry the F and some other index, say G. And this one carried the same index as Z, which is E, and which can be H. And then G and H can be distributed to these U's. Okay, I can try to distribute it. So I can see this guy carries, I'll figure out this later, G, H, H. And the upper one could be, that's how we utilize every single letter in our life. E, I, and then upper can be I, J. Oh my God. Okay, let's put it I, J on two. I don't like I, J to stand for spinner index, but I'm running out of index. So basically, this is how we restore all the spinner indexes. Is that the guiding rule, remember, is always you have U bar I slash minus psi. This is your integral one. Some with something integrated. So the thing we know is this is Lorentz invariant. And because of that, and you can keep track of which spinner get to contracted with your propagator, and then you can keep track of all their spinner index. And if you want to do it, that's how you do it. So for example, now I use my Dirac operator acting on my propagator. So this must have the index AF, matrix multiplication. And let's look at the next one. Next one would be this guy. So it must be X3 minus C. And then it must have CE. And then we have this guy is acted by this guy, so it must be y minus x1, this thing multiplied by this, so fh. We lose some index, which is good, since there's definitely plenty. So you get e and this jj tutor. Yeah? But now, like, you have to say this much simpler than before. Instead of having a bunch of Dirac operator, four Dirac operator and four propagator, they all disappeared. You're left with a bunch of delta. And now let me write this out. I also have U3 bar carries C index, makes sense. It gets 3 should stick with 3. And I have U4A index carry UA index because it's supposed to be contracted with that guy. And on this side, I have U1, it gotta be H. And I have U2, it gotta be this J2. So that's, aside from a bosonic propagator and a bunch of plane wave and a bunch of integral, this is what in the middle. Yeah? So the first thing I want you to notice is still focus on our spinner index. Hey, it says the 3 will become 2. 3 and the 2 are connected via index Z. Right? If you only staring at your spinner index, this is what this whole thing tells you. Is the 3 is going to go through here, and it goes through here, and it goes through here. If you look at the 4 red underlined things, since everything in between is just a bunch of a delta, what I can write out is that. So that's how we look at this thing. You probably suspect that's why that happens, but that's how it happens in the LSD reduction formula. And the other one is U4 bar dot to U1. So if you just keep track, this has a spinner index D, and it goes to C. A. This guy has index A, and it goes to this AF, the delta function, and goes to F. H and it goes to 1H. It goes to H. So that's how we get this term. And this is this little tilly part we deciphered out of this whole math can be summarized by a Feynman rule. Just after I add my arrows on my fermions, because remember fermions, they carry charges and so on and so forth. And the people's convention is that the arrow belongs to fermions. If you have an anti-fermion, you just have to draw an anti-arrow. Okay, so now if we look at our Feynman diagram, which is this guy. The Feynman rule can be summarized as apparently, so the first term, this red term, seems that it's about this line. See, the red term has only 2 and 3, has nothing to do with 1 and 4, and it's seems for a 3, I should give it a U3 bar. And for the 2, I should give a U2. That's just what end up showing up in this scattering amplitude. So now, because we painfully followed all those spinner indexes, we have 3 Feynman rules available. It says for each incoming fermion, we should associate a U spinner. For each outgoing spinner, we should also associate with a U bar spinner. And the way how they contracted to each other is you have to follow the fermion line, but you have to follow in the reverse order. See, the arrows going this way, but you have to follow this way. One quickest way to explain that is if I have those 2 spinners, if I want to make a Lorentz invariant object, I will have to use the bar guy to dot into the null bar. Yeah? And then you can see the other one's exactly the same for this guy. So So if I have gave this guy AU1, and I gave this AU4 bar, we will get this term without a further calculation. We discovered the three Feynman rules by carefully keep track of all the spinner indices to make sure we understand if we have these propagators after they are killed by the Dirac operator from LSC, what should we get? So if we reflected on the bosonic theory, it makes sense. If you think about the integral from the bosonic theory, it doesn't come with this thing. You don't need anything to carry your spin label or whatever. There is a one over there. If you think about it for the scalar, you also have integral a plus infinity minus a minus infinity. Oh, there's plane wave. Always plane wave. But what do you have? Is your Klein-Gordon operator acting on phi, some plane wave? Is there a plane wave? Yeah, there is. Okay. But there is nothing in front. That's why that your external leg rule for boson is one. What happened is you have a Klein-Gordon operator, it kills the propagator, there's nothing left. You're left with a one. But for fermion, it's different. You have a Dirac operator killing some Dirac propagator, but then this thing in front was left over. That's why the external fermion. So let me draw it really, really nicely and big over here. Is that what we discovered? So now we have a fermion incoming to this vertex, and this means it's a fermion coming into a vertex. Most of the time we'll just draw a small arrow says this is the momentum direction. So the particle is actually moving this way. And this arrow tells us it's a fermion. And if this is the case, we will associate this UR with all the index and momentum with our external leg. And the other one says, if this is the vertex and I have a fermion coming out, which is known as the outgoing fermion, and this is the incoming fermion, outgoing fermion carries U bar. And then remember the rule that how the spinners are contracting each other is you have to move along the fermion lines in the reverse order. You have to go against the arrow. The arrow points this way, you have to go the other way. And if you have some spinner, you just pick them up, and you got your scattering amplitude. Yeah.
I'm getting kind of confused with the arrows. Uh-huh. Like three, it looks like it should be an outgoing one.
Yeah.
That looks opposite to what you wrote over there.
No. Let me draw enough arrows. Okay. Yes.
Because.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If it's a bar, then it would be going away from the external point, right?
No, sorry. These are very good. No. That's internal vertex. So all these dots are internal vertex. So normally we don't draw a giant dot for the out, for the external leg. Like we draw these huge dots indicating there might be some other things going on. Okay, of course there is a simple rule that we already discovered, I just didn't tell you, is that if you see this guy, vertex, it should pick up minus island. I didn't say because you probably have already seen your homework, there's no difference there. The major difference is how we could be possibly writing down this without going through all that. And that those three rules, the third rule didn't see, is that going along fermion line, each fermion line, but in reverse order. Or you can say going against the fermion line. Either way, it means the same thing. You don't go in the direction where the arrow is pointing. You go in the other direction, and then you pick up the spinners that you see from the external line. Okay, so we are basically done, because all the rest of the stuff you have already seen. There is nothing new about being a fermionic series. So let's grab this bosonic operator and then write it here. So what we're going to do now is to realize that, so remember this x1, x2, xy, x4, all this plane wave that is chilling. Now they basically, we have four dirt functions. So there is e to the minus ik1. x1 is replaced by 1. And then there is e to the minus ik2. x2 is replaced by z. And on this side, you do the same thing. You have e to the ik3. x3 is replaced by z. And then e to the ik4. Then x4 is replaced by 1. Okay. So basically, you're left with a bunch of plane waves, and all your these integrals are done, because we just integrated over a bunch of third functions. So there, before, we have to integrate over x1, x2, x3, x4, y and z. But four of them is trivial. They have four third functions because of this Green's function thing. They just disappeared. All they do is turning the x1, x2, x3, x4 in the plane into y and z's. And of course, I have to do the y z integral. And of course, I have the momentum integral coming from the bosonic operator. So this is what we're looking at. But this is not something new. You must have seen something like this before. Aside from this two little thing, that the rest of you should have seen. Now what we do is gather all the plane wave that has y in it, and gather all the plane wave that has z in it. Yeah, you have a bunch of plane wave that has y in it. So this guy is e to the ik4 minus k1 and minus p times y. And the other one is something like k3 minus k2 plus p times z. And we know how to do plane wave integrals, so you get an even more dirt function. So this is just telling you that suppose I label the momentum here to be p, then each vertex, the momentum should be conserved. Right? That's exactly what these two integrals tell us. You get the dirt function of momentum conservation at vertex 1 and the momentum conservation at vertex 2. That will enable you to replace this p to, say, k4 minus k1. And if you look at this diagram, if there is a momentum k1 coming in, momentum k4 coming out, Then this scalar is either moving this way with a k1 minus k4 momentum, or it's moving the other way with the basically this, since we're going to square it, I'm not going to vary too much. So basically, the rest of the plane wave integrals, you must have seen it in the scalar theory. It gives you the vertex momentum conservation so that you can figure out what momentum is in your propagator. And then, of course, there is this final integral that will just give you the four momentum integration that you're going to sometimes even write it outside the scattering amplitude. So your this thing's final result is something like this, which is momentum conservation, overall momentum conservation. And then it comes with a propagator, which has some momentum you can calculate at the vertex. And on top of that, is the thing we figure out today, is how do we include the fact that this scattering amplitude is a Fermi. You should be able to recognize this scattering amplitude if there is no numerator. It's just a boson-boson scattering in lambda phi 3. And all fermion does is they say, we are fermions, we need this use a new bars, these spinners carry the information that we are fermions, we have spin labels, and dali dala. And this, what we did today is we figure out, in particular in the 2-to-2 fermion scattering, how do we write down these external legs. So we figure out the two external legs, and this rule that you need to go in the reverse order of the fermion line. And we also figure out that there is going to be minus signs involved. So let me box this final result, add back the minus sign, add back the minus I lambda square. Well, this is the final half of the result. I also have that one. But of course, I'm not going to do that one anymore. Because now I have Feynman rules. Why would I go through this to figure out what's the other one contribute? Right? I can just follow my Feynman rule says, this guy is U3 bar. This guy is U1. This is U4 bar, and this is U2. So I must be able to write something like that. I'll write it here. So it must be U3 bar get contracted with U1, and U4 bar get contracted by U2. And then now my momentum would be k3 minus k1 squared. Okay, I should be careful when I write the mass as big M for scalar. So the only difference is this has a minus sign, this one doesn't. So this is the glorious detail of how do we extract the Feynman rules of a specific calculation. I will see you guys in the afternoon for the Feynman rule for antifermions. You don't have to do this part in the afternoon. Now we can just be confident that this kind of thing will happen. They will, LSZ reduction formula is exactly designed to do that, is that it will come with Banach-Dirac operator acting on the external propagator and kill them. So you don't, you can ignore all that. And but we still have something to do to figure out the external legs for anti-ferments. Yeah.
So when we're following following these fermion lines,
yeah,
we're never going to cross onto the dotted line, I guess, right? But that's deep.
No, we're always going to. So this is, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
No. We are going to follow a fermion. That's basically why we,
yeah,
we could have found, why wouldn't we do that? We could ask this question, but then we follow through all this spinner index. We realize, okay, that didn't happen.
Will something change if there are more than two vertices?
Then we probably would do it on Friday to Thursday. No. Nothing will change. The rules are the rules. That's the point. The point is we're only going to go through this calculation once. Once we figure out the rules, we're happily applying our rules. We're not going to do it for three vertex. Oh, three vertex actually is zero. Because you only have three phis. So next one will be four vertex. And I'm not doing it. I'm definitely not going to do it for four vertex. No, if you, I think normally what causes the scaling amplitude doesn't have the momentum quantity. This is the result of all this. Normally this thing equals like the momentum conservation times the scale. Yeah.